Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and then our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. We have wanted to do a program on cyber response planning for quite some time, but we wanted to approach the topic to include a comprehensive emergency management perspective, not just system security. We understand that the folks in New England have been pioneers in this area, and we are grateful that they are here today to share their experience. Now, for any first-timers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you to hold your comments and questions until that part of the program. And you may wish to jot down anything as we go along. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Adam Wehrenberg, Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Grant Program Project Director for the City of Boston's Mayor's Office of Emergency Management. Mr. Wehrenberg is responsible for the oversight of catastrophic planning activities within the New England Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Initiative, which includes the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the states of New Hampshire and Rhode Island, as well as the Boston and Providence-Uazi regions. We are also pleased to introduce Kevin O'Shea, Information Security Lead for URS Corporation, who worked on this multi-year effort to regionalize the state and local response to a catastrophic loss of information infrastructure and communications. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. And I now turn the floor over to Adam to start us off, please.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much. Amy mentioned, I'm Adam Wehrenberg, and I'm the project director for the Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Grant Program up here in New England. And back in 2008, our executive committee identified cyber as one of the major hazards, the critical hazards that could severely impact government operations and the lives of our citizens. And so we set out with this program to establish a framework for incorporating the physical effects of a cyber disruption with emergency management and public safety folks with the technical expertise required to understand these issues. And so the resulting framework is what we'll present about today. So I'm going to take a few minutes to talk about the genesis of the project, the way that we went about it, and what our end state has been. And then I'm going to turn it over to Kevin, and Kevin will talk about some of the specific lessons learned from the project management standpoint. Kevin and the URS project team assisted us with technical expertise throughout the development of this framework, and so he'll be able to provide some insight from that perspective. So, there we go. So we recognize that this is an evolving concept, and as reliance on cyber infrastructure increases in all aspects of society, our cyber disruptions will evolve from mere inconveniences into major incidents with significant public safety ramifications. No longer is it just an aggravation that your email is not working, but there's potential in a fully interconnected world that your SCADA systems or your control systems or just simple things that the public relies on to get by on a day-to-day basis may be unavailable and have some cascading effects with regards to their reactions. So our cyber disruption planning project incorporates, as I mentioned, IT, emergency management, and public safety operations to ensure a consistent approach to terminology as well as incident command structure and a common understanding of expectations and dependence. So as I said from the top, we started thinking about this in 2008 with our executive committee identifying cyber as that critical hazard. And originally we talked about cyber attacks as being the hazard we wanted to work on. So the emphasis gradually shifted towards a cyber disruption response focus. And the primary reason for that is that the private sector owns and operates a majority of the critical cyber assets and the services on which the government relies. And this project was focused really on how do we mitigate the effects of a cyber disruption. From a government standpoint, from a continuity standpoint, you know, we're going to be required to manage response and the physical effects of that response, regardless of what limited responsibility we may or may not have to secure those assets pre-event. So that's how we ended up where we are. There was some foresight that cyber was going to be potentially an issue to tackle, and frankly, from an emergency management standpoint, we didn't have the knowledge base to understand what we didn't know. So from the emergency management standpoint, again, more than just email or file sharing, but our networks and our systems are really important to our operation and to the operation of our citizens. So whether we're talking about traffic lights or power infrastructure, criminal history systems, communications, all of this stuff is routed now through the majority of our IT infrastructure. And to maintain the continuity in the operation therein, we needed to understand what our reliance was on IT, as well as what we would be facing if something were to go down. So it's a lot more than just email and files. For our planning process, what we started out by doing was to identify our assets. We all maintain critical infrastructure key resource lists. The basic most critical infrastructure that we have in our jurisdictions, and we quickly realized that our critical cyber assets were not necessarily aligned with the CIKR list. And what I mean by that is the facilities that meant the most to us in terms of maintaining the cyber infrastructure didn't necessarily appear on those lists. They may not have been known. They may be hidden in plain sight. And specifically, those assets which had critical function for public safety functions were not necessarily on those lists. So after we set out determining what those assets were and prioritized them, we had to figure out what the risk was to those facilities. So we set out on a comprehensive risk and capabilities assessment program, identified what the current state was in terms of our ability to respond to anything that would occur at those assets. And then we began integrating this information into our regional plans. So in order to pull people together and complete that integration, we created what we're calling a cyber disruption team. For lack of a better term, it is the people that you would want as an incident commander or as an elected official at your right hand to tell you everything that you would possibly need to know about what your reliance and expectations for restoration are surrounding IT. So we pulled together for their technical expertise, IT personnel, for forensics and intelligence information sharing purposes, law enforcement, and then for a structured incident response standpoint, emergency management. And you can see this is really the core, but a full developed cyber disruption team includes other people at the fringes, the private sector, federal assets, service providers, power companies. The framework that we created allows people to set up this basic framework and then gives them the roadmap for integrating future asset owners or future capability owners. To make this scalable, the National Response Framework back in, I believe, 2008 identified cyber as one component of ESF2. So sticking with that national model, we decided that the CDT would be best incorporated within or alongside ESF2. Since we created a framework and not necessarily a specific operational plan, we left it up to the end jurisdiction, the end user, to determine how they integrated it into their processes. And for some jurisdictions, that was as an ESF 2A, if you will. For some others, it operated as one component within ESF 2. We didn't want to specifically spell that out and dictate that, but that's the direction that we put it, the direction we gave it. In addition to complete within an ICS structure, depending on the incident, depending on the scope of what's going on, it could either fall under planning or an operations section. But we wanted this structure to exist within the existing structure that people are already using. We didn't want to create an additional layer for response. We wanted to merely put it into something that is already known and already understood by the partners that would enact it. So what are we left with at the end here? We've created cyber disruption teams within each jurisdiction. We have created this group, this cadre of individuals within each jurisdiction. And as I say on this slide, it was adapted differently in each jurisdiction. Within Rhode Island, they've really taken it probably the furthest of any of our jurisdictions. They have emergency management, IT, law enforcement, higher ed, private sector, all very actively engaging with one another to share this information and to train and exercise on this structure to make sure that they're prepared. Massachusetts and New Hampshire are also doing the same thing. Those are our other two states. But I still think that Rhode Island has probably built this out the most clearly. We developed a regional cyber disruption response annex, which is a high-level document that sits on top of each of the cyber disruption team jurisdiction-specific plans and serves very basically to just coordinate that function. What we didn't want was a very lengthy plan that would be difficult to use or implement. So the plan is very brief. If you've read it or had an opportunity to see it in another venue, the plan is very basic. It merely identifies the roles and responsibilities for regional coordination and identifies how these people are going to share information and provides a series of templated documents for facilitating conference calls and other type coordinating structures. So it is very, very brief and to the point. We also created a training strategy, which if you were to take 3 years of your life to do online training, you could probably get through the majority of it. It is a very extensive list, but we identified throughout this process that there was a real need to have IT terminology understood by emergency management. IT, the reliance they had on IT as well, and had to be understood by the emergency management and public safety folks. Additionally, the emergency management structures and public safety structures, as I mentioned with ESF2 and under the ICS structure, that basic ICS information had to be known by the IT folks. And so there were a number of opportunities for cross-training that we identified, and our training strategy calls a lot of those out. So as the cyber disruption team matures, you want to provide certain training to your IT folks about public safety. You want to provide certain training to your public safety folks about IT, and then there's certainly plenty where they're both receiving the same delivery. The last document that we are left with is a resiliency annex, and this document really serves two functions. One, it memorializes our processes. So if you've developed a cyber disruption team within your jurisdiction, you can understand or be reminded of the methodologies that we employed for assessing our databases, assessing our assets. It will provide a start-to-finish process for understanding how we got to where we are. So for the people who have already established this the cyber disruption team and already gone through this process, it's a reminder. It's a punch list for the future in terms of refining your plans and procedures. For jurisdictions who have not been involved in this, one of our goals is to expand this as far as we can and provide this type of framework to as many people as possible. So the Resilience Annex is a tool for them as well in that it helps to identify the step-by-step process we took, and we were kind enough to leave out the rabbit holes that we fell down. So hopefully it will streamline the process a little easier for anyone new approaching this as opposed to some of the heartache that we might have felt in development. So hopefully it'll save some time and aggravation on the back end for anybody new. To call this project completed would somewhat be a misnomer. We look at this project as constantly evolving with goals at various points in time from here on out. So after about a year, and we're just about at that point, maybe a little beyond it. Memorializing gains has been completed through the completion of that resiliency annex. But as we continue to grow and as we continue to progress, we want our cyber disruption teams to continue to mature, to identify additional members and to incorporate them into their trainings or into their exercises, as well as provide this framework, as I've mentioned, to additional states or local jurisdictions. Really, it's scalable that anybody could adopt it. After about 5 years, and that's just kind of a nice round number, but what we see as a future success is if I can call on a cyber disruption team in the same way that I call on a tactical team or a bomb squad. FEMA right now has been working to create a typing mechanism before cyber assets. When we started this process, there was no typing structure from the federal level. So where you could request a Type 2 fire engine, you know the water capacity that you're going to get, you can't have the same classification on a cyber asset. It did not exist. So from our standpoint, if we can create a structure that enables that kind of sharing, be it of personnel, of resources, that is the direction that we'd really like to go. Additionally, as our grant has ended and as the ability to fund further improvements goes away, you know, we look to centers of excellence that are popping up to help us to continue this effort. In Massachusetts, for instance, there is a group called the Advanced Cybersecurity Center, and they've done a great job of incorporating public and private assets, higher ed, federally funded research and development centers. So they have a lot of different people looking at this from a number of different perspectives and sharing information about threats in real time. And the more people that we can get on board to understand the ramifications of a critical cyber disruption, I think the more buy-in we get over time. So it's really incumbent on the cyber disruption teams and on these centers of excellence to help us to continue the process. So at this point, what I want to do is I'm going to turn it over to Kevin to talk about some of the specific lessons learned from the project that we found at various points in the process. So.
Great. Thank you, Adam. So on the lessons learned, we're going to start here that one of the first big questions we needed to answer was, what is catastrophic? It's easy when looking at a, you know, Hurricane Andrew, Hurricane Sandy, or Northridge earthquake, it's catastrophic. It's immediately apparent. When we were talking about what's a catastrophic cyber attack or catastrophic cyber disruption, that was a bit different. We understand that if, for instance, you were to take the Internet away for a month, that would likely be catastrophic on a number of different levels. But what's the threshold? Is it an hour, a week, a month? And trying to determine that level was difficult. What we did is we really kind of worked around and said, well, we can work with our stakeholders, and we came down to a number of criteria. One was sustained impairment to a critical business process, so your inability to pay people or your inability to write prescriptions in a hospital, something like that. If that critical business function was impaired for a long period of time, that would likely lead to being disastrous, if not catastrophic. Now, it was also interesting that it was hard to map these secondary and tertiary dependencies and impacts, right? We know that IT is heavily reliant on power. We also know that power is heavily reliant on IT. We know that transportation is heavily reliant on IT, particularly rail. But we also know that power is heavily reliant on transportation. So as we started to look at these dependencies between sectors, it became a little bit more difficult to try and map how a catastrophic IT outage or an IT outage would be catastrophic because it may affect other sectors. So that was something that was complicating, but it was definitely an interesting thought exercise to work through. And it was easy for us to conceptualize, you know, events, incidents, disasters. As an aside, this was one area that the language barrier between IT and emergency management became obvious, because in IT, an event is something that just happens on the network or on a machine, a login, a logout, so on. And we only get to where we're mapping incidents would be something that requires, you know, intervention. In the emergency management world, we know events are, you know, things that need to be managed. So right there, getting a room full of people from IT and emergency management together, we already had a bit of a language divide. But we were all in agreement on what a disaster was. But then looking at, when does a disaster become a catastrophe? Right, if we have very large hurricane, right, or a sustained denial of service, or worm or virus infection where you need to be rebuilding hundreds of desktops, sustained power outage. You know, how long does the power need to be out for before it becomes catastrophic? Say, oh, well, people have generators, maybe 72 hours. If we were without power for 2 weeks, we would really start to feel the pain, and that would start to lean towards a regionally catastrophic event. So in looking at these low probability, high impact events, what we would, you know, are typically would call, you know, the black swan events in emergency management, it was an interesting exercise for us to work through what is a black swan event in the IT world, or what is a black swan event in your, you know, in the communications world. Because what we found is that if we did take away the internet infrastructure or the communications infrastructure, the impact was so great that even though it was a low probability, it ends up being something that on a risk management level, the impact is so large, it really should be considered within a risk management or comprehensive risk management plan. So in attempting to look at what is catastrophic, I would say that as a planning team, and including Adam, we were a bit overwhelmed with what are all the different situations and scenarios that can cause a catastrophic event. And what we looked at here was what are all the different threats that can cause an outage. And when we looked at all these different threats and gamed out, okay, a hurricane can lead to destruction of power lines, which leads to a power outage. But a hurricane can also lead to the physical damage of, say, a data center, and that can lead to loss of availability to your local network. When we started to map these out, we ended up finding that an infinite number of threats and scenarios led to a fairly finite list of effects. And this led to our next lesson learned, which was the benefits of using something along the lines of effects-based planning rather than scenario or threat-based planning. So here are scenarios: loss of power, loss of internet, loss of local equipment, and so on, really provided a finite number of planning scenarios, if you would, that we could begin to address at a catastrophic level. One of the benefits of this effects-based planning was that it seemed to have an effect of bringing people to the table willing to talk. We found when we used more mundane type events and extrapolated a mundane event out to be a large event, we got a lot of, how would you put it, Adam? We got a lot of resistance to the idea, or it was a large virus infection. Say, oh, well, we just had a virus infection the other day and we took care of it. It wasn't a problem. When we went to effects-based and we said, I don't really care how you get there, but let's say that you do not have access to your desktops anymore. You don't have access to your server room. What do you do? And it seemed to be that the effects-based planning got people focused on action steps that could be taken in preparation and action steps that could be taken during a response and recovery. And our meetings were more productive. So this is, again, just a lesson learned out to you in the community here. If you're having trouble getting traction on a difficult topic, this is one approach that worked well for us. So one of the next topics was the reliance on IT systems. And it was interesting moving through our stakeholder meetings how little the emergency management and law enforcement, and even to some extent, some private sector groups, how little they were aware of their reliance on the IT or cyber infrastructure. And cyber, I'm meaning colloquially the, you know, collection of networks and servers and desktops that allow you to connect and operate, you know, on the internet. So we found that people had little knowledge of the actual reliance on these systems, the interconnectedness of these systems, how much that other sectors and critical infrastructure would rely on the internet. And this was a good wake-up call for all involved, that your operations would likely be affected if IT went away, and that it's worth having that conversation with IT to really get a good understanding about exactly what your reliance is. You know, for instance, the radio systems, we kept hearing law enforcement say, well, we have our radio systems, we'll be fine. Many times on further investigation, we would learn that their radio systems at some point went to either leased lines or somehow went on the Internet as part of a trunked radio system, and that if there was some type of large-scale outage, their radio systems might be affected. That was something that they didn't know, but throughout this process, they became a little bit more aware of their reliance. So that's our lesson learned number three, is that it is really hard to conceptualize, map, and somehow way articulate all of the interdependencies we have within IT and communications across all of our sectors and critical business processes. And that, believe it or not, I don't know can be a very real answer when you're looking at examining these interconnectedness and the effect of, if we lose system A, what is the effect across systems B through Z? Oftentimes we don't know. It's not predictable. That's why referring back to this effects-based planning, since we weren't able to adequately predict all of the interdependencies, one of our only solutions is to say at some point we have to plan for this system being down or this system being disrupted in some way, and then to really focus on the effects, not being able to always map all the threats and vulnerabilities of systems and how they're interconnected. The next lesson learned was on managing large incidents. Emergency management does a very good job about managing chaos. It's what they do. Conversely, we did not see across the IT community that they had good policies and procedures to manage very, very large events or incidents. That being said, IT does a good job of, you know, a help desk, taking in tickets, calls for services, working through that in the work of the day of being able to take things in, prioritize, get it out. If we looked at incident that might last a week or more, or even several days, we saw a breakdown in IT's ability to manage that incident and be able to have a command structure, be able to have operational periods where people might be able to be relieved out, and to really be aware of all of the other resources that might be available to them to help manage and survive the incident. Things like public information officers or people that might do outreach to other affected communities, people that would handle logistics of bringing in food, water, medicine, sleeping arrangements if your technical staff was going to be stuck on site for a long period of time. So I think in the evolution of IT within our incident response and disaster recovery, I still see that there's room to grow regarding the management of a larger incident, and that emergency management principles, I think, can serve that community very well. The final lesson learned is that the halo benefits regarding planning for a catastrophic event far exceeded our expectations. So what I mean by that is we went into a room preparing for Godzilla to come walking out of the ocean and destroy everything. And what we ended up with was better policies, procedures to handle everyday events. So planning for the very unlikely ended up having immediate benefits to day-to-day operations well beyond what we were expecting. And we don't know whether, you know, it would have been interesting on a sociological level to find out why, but our quick hypothesis is that planning for events that were very rare ended up kind of having people check their egos at the door and be able to cooperate and participate in the process much more willingly than trying to work on a mundane day-to-day process and analyzing that process where people might have a lot more ownership or pride of ownership over a process. Planning for a very, you know, pie in the sky, never going to happen event seemed to get people thinking a little bit more broadly and a little bit more open to ideas and how they might change and address something of that nature. That's, as we like to see that say, that's the last 3 years of our life, and we hope that that some of our pain and learning points can help you moving forward. And what I'm going to do is turn this back, I guess, to Amy to moderate, see if there's any questions for us, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent overview. I will get our Q&A instructions up here. All right. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel and type in the area underneath, and then you hit send or enter. I am going to go ahead and close the chat panel at this time, just so we don't get confused as to where that is. All right. And then I will merely read the questions and comments aloud, and our guests will respond via the bridge. Please keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, so please do enter your comment or question at any time. And I've got the first one, which I will answer, from Jesse Truax, who asks, will these slides be sent to the participants? Jesse, we will have them posted at emforum.org this afternoon. What we typically do is send a link out via our mailing list next Monday when the transcript is also ready. So if you're on our mailing list, you'll get a notice. If you're not on our mailing list, you can just go to our homepage and subscribe from there. And during the rest of the Q&A, I will put this contact information back up so folks can refer to that. And Adam, I wanted to ask you, I did not find any links to any of the documents that you referenced, specifically the Resiliency Annex and I guess the actual Regional Plan Annex. Are those available anywhere, or can people request copies from you?
Sure. We haven't posted them anywhere publicly at this point, but I'm more than willing to share them with any constituents that want it. My contact information is there, so drop me a line or shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to send you our suite of documents. And I'm sure they're going to spark more questions than even answers, so I'm happy to work with anybody through it and answer whatever I can.
Very good. And are you all planning any more, I don't know if you go to conferences or do you have any other in-person type presentations coming up on your schedule?
None that I'm aware of that's specifically scheduled, but with each of our states, there may be some ongoing activities as each CDT is kind of taking it on their own, but none presently scheduled.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm still waiting on our audience. Any questions or comments on today's topic? One of the things I did want to ask about, and Adam, I'll direct this to you. Kevin, you please chime in anytime. I assume, can you tell us about any exercises that have been held by the, perhaps one of the state cyber disruption teams, or have they gotten that far to actually exercising some of this?
Sure. So when we first developed this, I think we finished the first real iteration of the Cyber Disruption Response Annex back in early 2011. And it was, you know, it was a framework at that point, more so than an actionable regional plan. And we wanted to test our base regional catastrophic coordination plan as well as this annex and another one that we had drafted. And so as part of that, we pulled together each state's cyber disruption team for a series of drills, and I believe there was an executive exercise first, and then we went into state-specific drills to, you know, to really just test that people understood the necessity of pulling together this team. not necessarily testing the technical skills and not necessarily striving to embarrass anybody for awareness of the plan or not, but just trying to justify the existence of the plan and test that people knew how to activate it. When we came together in April of 2011, that's when we had our big exercise on the regional catastrophic plan. So it was probably 3 or 4 months of lead-up time and a series of drills and executive-level seminars getting to that point. But we did a series of drills like that. And I know Kevin has worked with the Rhode Island Cyber Disruption Team specifically. Kevin, any...
So following, as Adam said, we did the executive drill, we did the 3 state-level drills, and then one combined, large combined exercise with the cyber plan and the IED plan. And I've been supporting the Rhode Island Cyber Disruption Team for the last year and a half or so on a series of tabletop and moving up to kind of a quasi-functional exercise. And even during the NLE 12, the Cyber Disruption Response Annex was used, and there was a Cyber Disruption Team regional call during NLE 12.
Yeah, and I've attended last week the National Lessons Learned Forum that we had here in Boston organized by FEMA, and I was also at the one on the West Coast in Santa Clara the week prior talking about this framework as one, you know, possible solution to getting people together into the same room to talk. NLE 12 was a great opportunity to test a lot of what we have. And as far as the regional catastrophic program at large, for those of you unfamiliar with the grant program, it only existed for 4 federal fiscal years. The first one, we were supposed to plan. The second one, keep planning. The third one, train. And then the fourth one, exercise. And so we're still setting the strategy for how we're going to implement the program in that fourth year, but it will likely include training at least at the discussion level, if not the operations level, for all of our plans, this one certainly included.
Okay, very good. Imogene has a question, and she asks, says, thanks for your fine presentation, gentlemen. Are there a number of similar projects or efforts underway around the country? I ask because, because of one or more hearings before Congress warning that the U.S. is woefully unprepared for cyber attacks.
So,
and Adam, you mentioned you've been talking to some of the other states, I believe.
Sure, there are, and one of the reasons why I had been invited to attend the West Coast Lessons Learned Forum a couple weeks back was the state of California, I know, is starting the process of pulling together a task force to deal with this. There are a number of other states that we've talked to in the process. One that specifically comes to mind is the state of Washington, within Michigan as well. Yeah, we've worked with Washington a little bit. We spoke with them at a conference on a panel together to talk about the similarities of our approach. So it's definitely something that people are looking at. I've spent some time on the phone with a number of states as they've gotten word of this plan, and I've distributed it to them. And like I said, it usually sparks more questions than it does answers. And so I've spent some time talking to some people, and it appears that this effort is something that is going to take shape in one form or another across all 50 states in the near future. So it's exciting to see the differences, and you know, we're hoping that we can create something positive for people to adapt to.
And let me follow up on that. I mean, have you been in touch with the folks at DHS that are responsible for the cybersecurity area at all?
Yeah, one thing that we learned pretty quickly was that there were a lot of federal partners with a lot of responsibilities for cyber.
Right.
and there are a lot of resources that are out there. I mentioned during my portion of the presentation that there's a typing effort that's underway right now. At least the first draft is complete that FEMA is undertaking. But we also have a cybersecurity advisor here in Region 1. I believe there are 3 or 4 across the country at the moment with the goal of there being 10 to map the same type of regions as FEMA regions. Region 1, we have one up here. And there's a lot of assessments and trainings that can be provided. We've been in talks with a number of the other federal agencies like the NCIC over the past few years. We had some of their folks come up and talk at a cyber summit that we hosted. So, yeah, we've been talking to pretty much anyone that will listen, but at the same time, trying to always put it into the scope of what are the assets that we can provide to our folks to ensure that they can continue this effort after the life of this grant. If there's, you know, it always comes down to money in one way or another, right?
Right. And just to, I'm going to build on Ava Jean's question there as well. It said, you know, I asked because one or more of the hearings before Congress warned that U.S. is woefully underprepared for cyber attacks. So that's kind of a two-issue question, right? One is, what is our cybersecurity posture, and are we ready to defend against attacks? And then the second part of that is how resilient is our infrastructure, meaning we are getting attacked, and how well are we going to be able to absorb and or recover from an attack? So, you know, where the cyber disruption team concept here really is looking again at those effects, that we are making the conclusion that, you know, if you look at the risk equation on this, you know, the chance of attack is 100%, and if you start running the math on that, at some point they will be successful. And what success is for the bad guy might be, you know, getting on your network and sitting there or shutting down a power plant. We just haven't seen the latter yet. So knowing that we do not have a tremendous amount of control over the private sector's control of critical infrastructure, that we are downstream to much of both power and IT/comms, that what is under our control is our ability to be, you know, to have resilience and multiple pathways to communicate and what have you, but also to mitigate and manage the disruption should it or when it occurs.
And you know, the purpose of our project from the outset was to make sure that the government could continue to provide critical functions.
Yes.
And understand the necessary order of operations. So if the system goes down and our prioritization is out of whack such that someone can get a driver's license but our police officers can't talk on their radios because we just didn't understand what the appropriate prioritization should have been,
yeah.
You know, then we would have missed the boat. And so our focus was on the continuity of government, but in order for this to be really successful, there has to be that next step of integration with the asset owners and with that private sector and with the people who can, you know, help make us resilient so that we're not just responding.
Yeah.
I've got a couple more questions in the queue, but before I get to them, I do want to just kind of follow up since you mentioned the private sector and just an overall a general question and terms, and I see some of that in your slides, Kevin, on the you know, the halo effects of you know, the benefits that extend even beyond the cybersphere. But my general question is, how was it working with the private sector? How involved were they? How cooperative were they? Just your impressions.
The original focus of this project was mainly on government systems.
Right.
So for the vast majority of the project, we were focused on government. And in all honesty, the reason we wanted to do that was we wanted to bring the government agencies we were working with up a few levels so that they'd be kind of talking as a peer with folks in the private sector as opposed to starting out the project and having the government folks be kind of a couple of steps behind. So we really wanted to make sure that we brought the government folks up a few levels and then really give them some good footing to engage the private sector. So the second part of your question is, when we did engage the private sector, it's been mixed. At times, the communications providers have been cool to participate. You know, and what we're trying to build is for the government to have these government agencies and to some extent even other private companies to have some transparency as to how resilient their systems are. And that resilience is going to look back at those dependencies on power and power and communications and IT and water and so on. And there is not a whole lot of transparency into how resilient those providers are.
Mm-hmm.
The providers, either for security reasons or trade secret reasons, keep that information pretty close to the vest. So we're making risk-based decisions without all the information we really need to make an educated risk-based decision. But other companies that we're working with, even the IT providers are feeling the same way about the energy providers. And, so we're all facing that same issue. And I think the more that we work together, we can, make better decisions and also be better prepared and have those contacts ahead of time should something bad happen.
And seeking out organizations like the one that I mentioned, the Advanced Cybersecurity Center, I know that in Rhode Island they're trying to formally establish I believe now it's being called the Cyber Center of Excellence formally. But, these folks have taken really competitors and then through no shortage of non-disclosure language, gotten them to sit in the same room and share the vulnerabilities of the threat vectors that they're seeing as a means of strengthening their entire sector. Those types of organizations are great to have. Oftentimes they need to be spearheaded from outside of the government. If you can seek one of those out in your jurisdiction, those are a great type of organization to be part of and to receive information from or give it to.
Very good. Thanks. Okay. Ray Pena says, can you please describe in general terms how the community would respond to an unexpected cyber-related multi-state power outage? Focus on resolving cause and how immediate effects would be handled. And I think basically what he's asking for here is, what are the goals and tasks for these disruption response teams?
Okay. As a purely theoretical, I'll take Rhode Island as an example just because I've been working with their team most extensively. So the cyber disruption team down there is made up of, it's led by law enforcement. It has participation across academia and a number of private sector companies, including Raytheon, RBS Citizens, and Dell SecureWorks is down that way. And they have team members that have pledged time and energy should some large disruption happen. So we've actually done this very similar question here in an exercise to where the power company has some cyber-related event, and it's beyond their ability to figure out what's going on, and they're calling in for help from the cyber disruption team. Now, in reality, that power company might be calling an incident response company like a Mandiant or someone else like that or even Dell SecureWorks to come in. But in this case, let's say the cyber disruption team also gets the call. They would be forming up and moving out and helping manage the incident as much as providing technical support. So they might be providing logistical support and planning support and things of that nature. We're not really sure, again, in reality, we're not too sure how much the power company would let outside people be on their networks and meddle around on their networks, but that's why the Rhode Island State Police is there, and if they were coming in as a law enforcement function, they may get more headway than just if the team was made up of a bunch of volunteer, folks from corporations. So that's kind of how we see it happening. Power is probably maybe not the best example. We've used some examples for maybe one of the state-run hospitals, something like that they might be turning to state resources to help out. But we do see the cyber disruption teams kind of the concept expanding, and again, be mainly focused on how they manage the incident and helping pull in the right technical resources over what might be a response period that would last, 24, 36, whatever, 96 hours, something like that.
And then, Adam, of course, in the state, in the scenario of the multi-state, that's what your response the regional plan annex would coordinate that multi-state, correct?
Yeah, and as we, you know, we developed this regional cyber disruption response annex, and it's really focused on information sharing first and foremost. We would hope that as the typing becomes more applicable to what we're working on, whether it's physical assets or more likely personnel, that we could leverage the existing interstate authorities like an EMAC to send personnel over, you know, across borders, have them assist one another, and be able to understand, okay, a type one cyber disruption team comprises, you know, this capability, X capability,
right,
and you guys can come in and assist. I think Kevin will tell you what one of the things that we found is, you know, every IT network is completely unique and different from every other IT network, and nobody could possibly work on mine. But we're hoping that that capability and as a typing mechanism comes into play and there's some established consistency, that we can break down some of those barriers as well.
Yeah.
Right. And this leads right into the next question. R. Bostic asked exactly about this. He says, "Works scenarios explored where cyber support may be requested from out of region, state, and what types of scenarios?" Thanks.
So, Faye, you're right on. Or I'm sorry if it's, but Bostic, R. Bostic. you're right on with where some of the original concepts for the cyber disruption team were headed. That we believed that, as Adam was joking, like, oh, my gosh, my network's so unique and whatnot. Really, when you look at it objectively, we have, like, 2 to 3 manufacturers of large switches. We all use IP. We're pretty much settled on either, you know, an Exchange backend or, you know, a Windows backend or a Linux backend. The amount of variability across one network to the next is not really that much. So the idea that you could have a network tech or someone like that be loaned from another jurisdiction, I think, is very reasonable. What we're finding is that we are likely a generation or two away from that concept being accepted within the IT community. Just as mutual aid for law enforcement and fire took a couple of generations to get through, like, hey, my fire truck is unique. No one could find out where the halogen bar is on my fire truck. And, well, guess what? That's all standardized now, and you get mutual aid all the time, and it's completely accepted. And I think that the cyber disruption team lays out that framework, but I think we are a little ahead of our time when it comes to actually sharing of personnel or resources. But I think that that's coming. Again, it's one of these that we were the fine line between genius and crazy, and I think for the moment we sound crazy. Maybe in a year we'll be geniuses. Who knows?
I think you sound like geniuses right now. Adam, you mentioned the resource typing for these teams that's currently ongoing. You said the status of that. You think there's a draft that's been done. Do you have any more information about what their plans are with those, one that might be coming out?
You know, I don't, but I think the last I saw, I think it was probably a month or two ago, and I believe it's coming, and it's something that FEMA is really working on in earnest. So I think that, you know, I think it's something that we'll see evolve, and just based on the rate of change of cyber infrastructure, it may very well be a little dated by the time it comes out of the box. But, you know, from a principal standpoint, I think it's something that we're going to see in the near term and derive some benefit from.
Yeah, and I hope with that typing that it's at the intelligent level to where it's not immediately obsolete. You know, I'm hoping that they put it at the appropriate level to where you can order, you know, through EMAC or through Stafford Act or what have you, when you order a piece of equipment, hey, I need a switch, and it needs to have this general capability at this general speed or something, to where that's when I think we're going to start to see more of the resource sharing, when that resource typing is accepted and, again, is at that right level where people are not immediately, you know, suspicious of it or immediately disregarding it because it's either too specific and it's now referring to equipment that's gasped, you know, 3 months old. Oh, God, we could never use that.
Well, we're about coming to the end of our hour. I don't have any more questions in the queue, but one last thing I would like to touch on is basically what you started off with, Adam, I think, and how awareness from non-IT types of folks, how much all kinds of systems rely on this infrastructure and how they might be impacted. I mean, I liked your effects planning, but I almost think the effects might even need to be spelled out even more. You may be looking at, you know, terrible traffic, you know, all these cascading effects. I understand you cannot map all of these, but loss of water, you know, potable water, loss of all these various systems. And so I think anything that can be done to, you know, bring awareness to folks, and you obviously did that throughout your effort, and it did seem like you were struck by that as well, how folks were not really aware of how much they rely on this infrastructure.
Yeah, absolutely, and getting, you know, the effects-based plan came really in handy, as Kevin mentioned, in getting both sides to the table. You eliminate the help desk mentality of I can solve this immediately and it's not a problem, and then from the public safety and emergency management side, okay, I don't know what a spoofing attack or a
right.
denial of service attack is, and I don't really care, but the end result is that, you know, I can't distribute my information to the public in the way that I'm used to, or you know, something gets defaced on the city's website, I need to deal with the physical ramifications of that. And so for us, the scenarios became irrelevant, and that really made a lot of people change the way that they thought about this, or the way that they thought they had to think about it, in a way.
Yeah.
And so I think as we again further mature these cyber disruption teams, you'll see these folks delve a little deeper into the specifics of the cascading effects. But for us, you know, just getting people in the room was a huge victory, and that certainly helped us do it.
If I could, I'd just add on one item to that where you were talking about the dependencies. But throughout the process, again, it's oftentimes in the planning that the actual planning process is so much more valuable than the deliverable itself. And we found in several occasions where the process of going through this that certain critical infrastructure like data centers were not on their critical infrastructure list. And they weren't, you know, folks were not aware of how reliant, for example, power was on IT. And being able to make some of those connections, and like you're saying, how potable water might be affected and so on, it allowed people to then make better risk decisions because they were making assumptions that everything would be okay and that, you know, an IT outage wouldn't affect water. Well, all of a sudden when they learn that, they start then changing some of their own risk equations to account for that, and then I think that really had a very, very broad effect well beyond this project.
Right. Okay, well, I think we'll go ahead and wrap it up for today. On behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants, thank you very much to both of you for being with us today and sharing this information. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to give us a little feedback on the program. Again, thanks to everyone for participating today. Have a great afternoon, and have a safe and happy 4th of July. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Bye now.